Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as intelligence brief on the war for the free world. I have come to know over many years now a man who has really had a clarity about particularly the Middle East portfolio within that larger war for the free world. Through his service to successive secretaries of defense over decades, and during the time when I served in the Pentagon with him, it was a pleasure to draw on his expertise. It has been a pleasure to witness his service going forward from there. Today, Dr. Harold Rode is a fellow with the Gatestone Institute, capping truly decades of very important service to our country, and it's a delight to have him with us to talk about the Iran deal, such as it is, about which you're knowledgeable in some of the particulars, Harold, but particularly about the context, the people we're negotiating with, their conduct. So welcome back. It's great to have you with us from Jerusalem, as it happens.
Frank, it's always great to be on your show.
Harold, before we get into the state of play with the Iranians, talk a little bit about the nature of the regime that we are dealing with, both in terms of its structure, its ambitions, both in the nuclear space and beyond, and the prospects of actually having anything useful done in the course of negotiations with such a regime.
In the Middle East, and in particularly in Iran, you only negotiate after you win. If you sue for negotiations before you win, it's a sign of weakness. That's how the Iranians understand it. And that President Obama and Secretary Kerry wanted to negotiate before the United States won and basically dictated the benevolent terms in which Iran was to function shows the Iranians the Americans don't have the will or the ability to do what is necessary to impose the American will. The result is when Iranians see this, that's when they pounce. And if you look at what the president and the secretary of state have done in the last year or so of negotiations, it's constantly giving in on red line after red line after red line. Now we have whatever this agreement is. Now the Iranian version is completely different from the American version. The Iranian version has a lot of this will be done, that will be done, all passive voice, which means in Persian and Iranian culture that it will not be done. So whatever they supposedly agreed to with our Secretary of State and President, it's a sham. It's a lie. They see this as one more step, a hoax, complete hoax. It's one more step in the process of getting exactly what they want, which is a nuclear weapon. And that has two meanings. It's not only a problem for Israel. But they already have, if I understand correctly, the ability to deliver that nuclear weapon and missiles to Europe, which I think is why the Europeans are more concerned. And with time, what the Iranians are working on, and they're a very, very smart people, is they will have the ability to shoot missiles with nuclear weapons when they get them, if we don't stop them, at the United States and America. Is that what we want? But that won't happen in the next year, so it won't be on Obama's watch. So someone else would get blamed.
Look, Harold, it may happen in the next year. I think anybody's guess at this moment as to exactly where the Iranian ballistic missile program, specifically their intercontinental range ballistic missile program, stands, to say nothing of the nuclear program. So I don't think we should foreclose the possibility that it will be on his watch. But let me ask you this, Harold. Among the many acts of malpractice, it seems to me, malfeasance that the administration has engaged in, is the insistence by John Kerry that the Iranians have lived up to all of the terms of their previous commitments. I don't believe there's any basis for that statement, knowing this regime as you do. What do you make of that kind of representation to the American people?
I think it's ludicrous. absolutely ludicrous. I think, and it's only my assessment, I can't know, Mr. Kerry and Mr. Obama wanted a deal. And whatever the price was, they wanted a deal so they could say they could have a deal. And so they gave in on anything, and they'll continue to give in on other things as well. I don't even know what they are, but the Iranians will continue to press and to press and to press because they smell weakness. And as I said before, that's when they pounce. This does not bode well for the United States and the United States allies, which, for example, these would be the Gulf Arab powers, the Sunni Arab powers, which have been for decades in some alliance or so with the United States. They see that America is giving in to Iran, which culturally as Persians and religiously as Shiites are their mortal enemies. And I would say that there is what has developed is a tactical alliance between Israel and all of these Arab Sunni governments who really in the long run, they have no love for Israel, that's for sure, but they are totally on the same side. And America's job in the world is to lead. It is, whether we like it or not, we are the world's policemen. We are the strongest power, at least we used to be the strongest power on the face of the earth before this administration. I don't know now.
Well, we're witnessing it being weakened. And unfortunately, the others who are likely to fill that vacuum are not going to be leading the world in a direction that will be consistent with our interests or security.
They will not be interested in freedom and democracy and human rights.
For sure. Harold, listen, let me quickly double back on something about this regime that I think we have to understand. You rightly indicated that should the Iranians get their hands on nuclear weapons, that is a problem not just for Israel, not just for our so-called allies in the Middle East and perhaps in Europe, but for us as well. Give us a quick flavor of why the Iranians are different from the Soviets, who we used to think we could deter. And why, if in fact they do actually acquire the means for mass destruction against the great Satan, which they call us, this is potentially truly a mortal peril.
Here's the difference. With the Soviets, and I'm not a Soviet expert, but we had something called MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction. We believed, and it seems that the Soviets now have believed, that we would destroy each other. But for Iran, for this particular government of Iran right now, which even the Ayatollah Khomeini, who really founded the Islamic Republic, he hated these people because he was sure that they would bring about a catastrophe where Iran would be destroyed. Now, here's the thing. Nuclear weapons become an incentive for this regime because they believe their particular type of extremist, radical Shiism, believes that they can provoke a conflagration, and as they're losing, which they would believe they were, then by doing so, they're going to make their prophet Muhammad and Ali, who is his son-in-law and the beginning of all of Muhammad's descendants, and the final missing imam, he's called the Mahdi. He disappeared in 872, 873, and he is going to reappear, and they can make him reappear. How do they do this? By provoking a conflagration where they're losing. And then their prophets, their imams, their leaders will come down and save them. Therefore, the difference with the Soviets boils down to a simple thing. Nuclear weapons and a conflagration are incentives for this regime. It's not like with the Soviets. They are where they were disincentives. That by provoking a conflagration, their prophet and their leaders will come down and save them, and that will prove in the Muslim world, so they believe, that their form of Islam is the correct Islam. This is unbelievably dangerous.
In other words, the most dangerous guys we could imagine, if they're even worse than the Ayatollah Khomeini, are running the place now. We're making concessions to them. They're building the nuclear weapons with which to bring about their end-time scenario. And the momentousness, the magnitude of the peril that we face as a result is almost unimaginable. Harold Rode, your understanding of these threats is more urgently needed today in our government than ever before. I hope at the very least that by communicating these messages as you have recently in your piece about why Iran is winning and by your appearance on our program that we can assure that at least people in positions of power and influence are apprised of the true gravity of this danger. Thank you for taking the time to join us, and we look forward to visiting with you again very soon. Next up, blogger and author Diana West joins us. We'll talk with her about this Iran deal and what the Senate has now done to exercise some influence on it, or did they? That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitz for the Center for Security Policy. Over the last week, it has become clear that the so-called framework agreement announced by the Obama administration to bring about a comprehensive nuclear deal with Iran is in deep trouble. Iranian officials have disagreed with the Obama administration's account of the framework, especially over verification and sanctions relief. Contrary to U.S. claims that there will be strict verification and phased sanctions relief, Iranian leaders have said verification efforts will be limited, with military facilities off limits. They also insist that sanctions must be completely terminated, not suspended, once a final agreement is signed. So if there was not agreement on the framework, what's going on here? The likely explanation is that the framework is a fraud to stop Congress from passing legislation imposing new sanctions on Iran or requiring a congressional vote on a final nuclear agreement. It is my hope Congress will not be fooled by this obvious fraud. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. Diana West is our guest. She is our regular feature here, commenting on matters of all kinds, most especially, though, the global jihad and what it portends for Western civilization. She is a syndicated columnist of many years standing, now a blogger at DianaWest.net, a best-selling author with terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. Diana West, welcome back. Always good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be with you.
Well, we have been witnessing what I think of as kind of the Emperor's New Clothes story playing out in the form of this agreement with Iran that doesn't seem to actually be an agreement at all, an agreement to agree at some point down the road, but not on any of the particulars. We now have the Senate of the United States in the form of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee seemingly creating conditions under which there might be a vote on whatever comes out of this at the end of June or whenever. And yet it seems as though the deck is going to be stacked against critics of the deal. What do you make of all of this, Diana? And what should we make specifically of the prospects that it will leave Iran with the inherent capability, if not the actual one, of a nuclear capability?
Well, of course, that's always the dire result of this fecklessness that we're witnessing. I think that the bigger problem for us in some ways is the behavior of the United States Senate. I mean, yes, Iran can pose an existential threat with nuclear weapons, of course. However, what are we looking at internally? What are we looking at in America where you would see the kind of machinations in the Senate committee just recently to basically detach themselves and remove themselves from the deal. In other words, not to make this an overwhelming majority approving of the bill, but rather to make it possible for a minority to allow the bill to pass. I mean, this is craziness, and the question becomes why, and the solution, or at least the remedy, would be to find out why this happens, but the mechanism for finding out why that happens is its hearings in the Congress, and they seem to be part of the fix.
I mean, the fix is in the sense of rather than fixing the problem. Our guest is Diana West, a nationally renowned author and, well, I believe a pundit of the first order on matters of great importance to our civilization. And specifically, Diana, you have been tracking very closely the jihad and what it entails and what we have to be doing if we are to survive what they have in mind for us, which is our destruction. We were talking about the Iranian bomb and what a threat that represents, and the fact that we seem so witless about it on both sides of the aisle, sadly. Let's turn to another example of the problem, and that is what is playing out in Europe at the moment. You've just written a very powerful piece about a fellow by the name of Lars Vilks in Sweden. I don't think that's a household name. Tell us about him and what his story suggests is afoot there and possibly here as well.
Yes, well, Lars Vilks is one of these senior citizen Scandinavian men on whom the weight of Western civilization rests. There are several of them. What I mean by that is he's a very courageous man. He's actually an art history professor who draws cartoons. Cartoons include depictions of Muhammad. This has been going on for some time. He's one of the most attacked, assaulted. People may have come across his name in a recent attack, a jihad attack in Copenhagen on a cafe where he was going to give a talk about freedom of expression. This is what's going on in Europe today, which has been going on for some time now. But what we're looking at with the example of Lars Vilks is his own government. He is Swedish. His own government now has declared that he can no longer live in his home because it is indefensible. In other words, Sweden is so much a land of jihad itself, it is so completely infiltrated and penetrated that the authorities there, who are there to maintain the order, of course, of its citizens, are actually declaring surrendering, essentially, Swedish territory. And Lars Vilks is now a homeless person being shuttled from secret secure location to secret secure location. He is not the first, but he is the latest in this, and to say it bodes ill is the understatement of the century. It is another measure of the kind of moral surrender that we have witnessed. And my interest, of course, is the jihad, but specifically the jihad against the Western mind, because this is all about psychological adjustments to incursions of Islam and jihad in our midst. It's not so much about kinetic fights and so on and military actions against terror groups. This is about what happens to the Western mind under the pressure of Islam, a condition, of course, we have discussed in the past as being that of dinitude, which is a whole manner of capitulations and acquiescences to Islamic law. And here we see it played out in the most official way in a country like Sweden.
Mm-hmm. We were talking about this political jihad, if you will, political warfare with our first guest, Harold Rode, on the question of this Iran negotiation, but to stay with Sweden and what you're seeing play out there, Diana, and in your article at dianawest.net, you describe the circumstances under which journalists were able to meet with Lars Vilks recently. Give us a flavor of that, because this really brings home the degree to which he is now condemned to a life of very considerable restriction on his freedom, to say the least. And what does that suggest is afoot for the society, Swedish society, for starters?
Yes, well, this is the state of Swedish society, and this instance you're talking about is when a few journalists were permitted to meet with Lars Vilks in a mobile home on a field. They were guarded by dozens of armed policemen, dogs. There was a helicopter nearby. It was deemed too unsafe to meet with him anywhere else, so they settled for this secure location. I mean, it sounds like something out of a bad TV show, something very surreal and futuristic, but this is the state of a society under the press of jihad. It is classic, and it is happening. It is not something that is coming down the pike. They have arrived.
And Diana, talk a little bit. Again, our guest is Diana West, best-selling author and blogger par excellence. You can find her writings at dianawest.net. What is the state of Sweden more generally? I understand cities like Malmo have essentially become not no-go zones. They've been essentially taken over by this jihadism. And is that true more generally in that country, or are they fighting back in any appreciable way? And again, just to bring it home, what are the early indicators that we're seeing similar kinds of accessions or concessions to these accommodations to these jihadists here in the United States?
Well, in Sweden, there is a very valiant and vibrant party known as Sweden Democrat that has been doing better in their parliamentary system and indeed threatens the order. They have had very good success at the polls lately, but they are not in charge by any stretch. This is essentially the attack, the twin attack of multiculturalism, which of course is a form of Marxism, overlaying with the Islamic incursions by demographics. And I think that this has to be understood as a demographic war, which we can take to our own shores, not necessarily completely in Muslim demographics, but just the entire immigration tsunami we are experiencing that includes many people from Islamic countries, from the Middle East and elsewhere, but also huge masses from all the rest of the world, primarily Mexico and South America.
This is a subject we're following closely with Ann Corcoran's work on the refugee resettlement program. Really important stuff. Diana, we're going to have to leave it at that for the moment, but this is an incredibly important topic. I appreciate so much the work that you do, helping us understand the civilizational piece of the political jihad. And I hope you will keep it up, and we look forward to talking with you again next week. We'll be speaking with Rick Fisher next about the massive buildup of China's Navy and what that means for us. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're all part of your community.
We all play a role in keeping our community safe.
So protect your every day.
If you see something suspicious, say something to local authorities.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. On the surface, yesterday's insistence by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that Congress get a vote on a nuclear deal with Iran appears to be a victory for what is left of our constitutional republic. Two clues suggest otherwise. First, the panel's legislation was adopted unanimously. And second, the White House says Mr. Obama is willing to sign such a bill. The president and his partisans on Capitol Hill are on board for a simple reason. Instead of this deal facing the high hurdle the Constitution requires for treaties, in which the executive branch must persuade two-thirds of the Senate to approve it, the mechanism set up by the proposed legislation will require opponents to come up with that supermajority in both houses of Congress. This arrangement serves Iran's interests, not America's. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. It's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. No matter what happens, if it matters to you and you listen long enough, you'll learn what it means and different ways to think about it. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
This is Frank Affney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Affney.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by a man who I think of as one of the country's preeminent authorities on the state of and future prospects for China's military. He is Rick Fisher. He is a senior fellow at the International Assessment and Strategy Center, the author of numerous books and countless articles. The most recent of his books is China's Military Modernization, Building for Regional and Global Reach. Very much the topic on my mind at the moment. Rick Fisher, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Frank, thanks for having me back.
Your assessment, Rick, of what China is up to has been, to say the least, bracing and very worrying for a long time. I wanted to see what you made of the findings of a recent study released, I believe, just in the past week by the Office of Naval Intelligence about China's Navy and really seemingly quite extraordinary buildup taking place there. What do you make of it, and what should we as a nation be doing about it?
Frank, the politics of this document released a week ago is fascinating. The Bush and Obama administrations, until this point, had resisted issuing assessments of China's military in such bold, colored, illustrated, charted, extensively detailed documents until now. There was a bias to prevent any assessment coming out of the Pentagon that would cast China as a Cold War level threat. And this document, which very much resembles the old Soviet military power series that you remember, from when you were working for Cap Weinberger in the 1980s is very much at the forefront when we look at this new ONI report. The Pentagon has decided to cast aside the limits and be very frank and detailed in its assessment of the PLA Navy. And there are two major takeaways. First, across the board, the Chinese Navy is expanding rapidly and developing very modern systems. And second, ONI, between the lines, is essentially telling us that China's Navy will have a global projection capability before too long. And it's not just the challenge that we'll be facing in Asia, helping to defend our allies in Asia, helping defend Taiwan, perhaps, but we will be facing Chinese maritime challenges all around the world.
Rick Fisher, what is it, and I want to come, of course, to the details of the ONI findings, but what is it that has prompted this change, do you think? Is it the sheer magnitude of what the Chinese are up to that can no longer be ignored, or that there's a heightened sense that the danger that it represents is such that it is well, malfeasant not to speak honestly about it at this point?
Well, it's simply blazingly obvious that, first, the Chinese Navy is expanding hand over fist. But secondly, and perhaps more importantly for our naval operators, our naval forces and commanders on the front line, as Chinese Navy capabilities increase, China is using them, not just to escort its shipping in the Gulf of Aden to counter pirates, but it is using its Navy to expand its presence globally and to increase pressure on Japan and allies in Southeast Asia over disputed maritime territories.
In other words, to project power for strategic purposes, not just tactical situations. And Rick, let's talk a little bit about some of the most important of the findings. I was particularly struck by the sheer magnitude of the number of hulls that are being laid down per year, especially when contrasted with the relatively paltry number we're building at any given time. But also, you've pointed out the quality of the vessels and their multi-purpose systems that make them pretty formidable, as I understand it.
Yeah, the report states very clearly that all told, in 2013, 2014, and again, and probably in 2015, China will be working on, in some manner, 60 hulls, new hulls for its naval forces. That is viewed by some of my colleagues as a wartime footing. And the systems that China is developing, the new anti-ship missiles, supersonic anti-ship missiles, longer-range anti-aircraft missiles, modern radar, electronic warfare systems, helicopters that are improving in capability, the beginning of its aircraft carrier fleet, and the rapid progress in both its conventional and nuclear-powered submarines.
Rick, as a serious student of these matters, and I think you are one of the most serious of them, when you see this kind of buildup, and I think a wartime footing is not an exaggeration, is there any conclusion you can draw from it other than that China is intent on exercising a hegemonistic power over at least its own region that extends ever further into the Western Pacific, as well as, of course, Asia proper, but truly on a global basis at this point? And again, what does this portend for us as, you know, a nation committed to freedom of navigation and, you know, an international order that is free of this potentially serious encroachment and threat?
Well, Frank, what's most alarming to me is your last point about global projection. In February, the president of Argentina visited China and quite publicly, in open public communiques, described how China is going to start rearming Argentina, which has made very public its intentions to try to reclaim Britain's Falklands Islands off its coast. China will be exporting the means for Argentina to build its own armored personnel carriers. It will be building new warships. And a special committee was set up to investigate the possibility of selling new combat fighters to Argentina. This is just the beginning. By the time China is selling Argentina advanced surface-to-surface missiles, perhaps anti-ship missiles, long-range patrol aircraft, submarines, the PLA Navy may be able to project to the South Atlantic to deter a British rescue mission for a second Falklands War. This is the kind of troublemaking that China is going to be very much behind, not just in Latin America, but in Africa and along the rim of the Pacific. And the United States Navy already faces a very substantial Chinese challenge. We're stretched very thin in Asia today. Imagine if we don't radically increase the size of our own Navy, we won't be able to deter Chinese adventurism that will be taking place basically on a monthly basis all around the globe.
Yeah, in key choke points, most especially where they can exercise considerable influence over what happens on the seas, under the seas, over the seas. Rick Fisher, again, is our guest, senior fellow with the International Assessment and Strategy Center. And Rick, just sort of a closing thought. You mentioned my old boss, Cap Weinberger. I remember vividly the role that he and the Reagan administration played in helping a far more capable Britain at the time project its power to assure its continued control of the Falklands. Britain is nowhere near that capability any longer, I'm afraid. And certainly there's no evidence that the Obama administration would come to its assistance as we once did. Rick, this is just really a very quick overview of a very important topic. I had wanted to talk with you at greater length about, notably, the submarine-launched ballistic missile capabilities that are part of this buildup, as well as sort of the implications of this huge industrial capacity that the Chinese are now bringing to bear for sustaining a sort of a wartime production operation, but that will have to wait for another day. Thank you very much for taking the time today to join us, and I look forward to that further conversation in the near future. Next up, I'll be speaking with Hasvinder Sangvera about honor diaries and the threat of jihad to women and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGT. SullivanCenter.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitch with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the global jihad movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm pleased to say joined for the first time, I believe, by Jaswinder Sangera. She is a victim of a forced marriage, a survivor of it. A woman whose own experiences have transformed her into a champion of women's rights, particularly through a marvelous vehicle she's founded in the United Kingdom entitled Karma Nirvana that supports all those impacted by forced marriages and something called honor-based violence. She is the author of an important book entitled Shame, which apparently had such a profound impact on Prime Minister Cameron of the United Kingdom that it actually moved him to criminalize the practice of forced marriage. She's also helped engineer a National Day of Memory in the United Kingdom through a petition on this subject. It is a delight to have her. I've watched her on a number of occasions in an important appearance in a film called Honor Diaries by the Clarion Project. And it's a great privilege to have her with us. Jaswinder, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk about your work and why you're here in the United States at the moment, trying to impress upon us the menace really posed by this practice of, as you call it, honor-based violence. Glad to have you.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about manifestations of this phenomenon, because I think most Americans are unaware that it even exists, let alone what it entails. Honor-based violence is what?
Well, if I can talk from personal experience, my personal experience and that of my seven sisters was that we were born in Britain. I'm one of seven sisters. You know, my father's heritage was Sikh. He came from India as a migrant, settled in Britain. And we were brought up within a family dynamic that operated an honor system. Now, what this means in practice is that our beliefs and value systems were rooted in this concept called honor. And it actually controlled our behavior. Every facet was controlled. Certainly our sexuality was. We had the power as young girls and young adolescent women to dishonor and shame the family. And we were told what this meant. So basically, we were told that we had to be submissive. We had to act modestly. We were not allowed to wear makeup, cut our hair, even integrate in wider British society. We're not allowed to even look at a boy, let alone date a boy. All these behaviors of normal adolescent teenage behavior was deemed as shameful. So we were told that if we behaved in that way, then we put ourselves at risk. And that risk meant that we could be punished. That punishment could be psychological. It could be physical. If the family even perceived we were dishonoring them, it could be a trigger for a forced marriage. And what we know in today's context, it can mean significant harm, even murder. So this is a concept that is very much alive within communities, not just South Asian communities, other communities as well. And women understand their responsibility to it and are ruled by fear.
And other attributes of this practice, in certain traditions at least, involve beyond forced marriages, often very young girls for that matter. As you've mentioned, honor killings, female genital mutilation, and the like. How are you trying to counter this kind of practice, especially in societies where the host population, if you will, is probably largely ignorant that they're even taking place?
Yeah, absolutely. The fundamental thing in terms of the counter message is to raise awareness, awareness amongst the majority community, not just within those communities, because this was in the UK is a very British problem. Just as in America, this is an American problem. So the need to raise awareness and also to counter the myths around this. This is not a religious practice. This is not part of one's tradition. Nobody is doing this in the name of Islam, Sikhism, or Hinduism, or the major faiths. In fact, those major faiths actually fundamentally speak out against forced marriages and honor abuse, any form of abuse. So we are framing this as child and public protection, that cultural acceptance has not been accepted and acceptable. We've got to get people to recognize this as a human rights violation and a rights issue.
And I want to come back to this question of the grounding in certain religious practices, but just stay with this issue of raising awareness. One of the challenges you face, as I understand it, is the difficulty even getting the authorities to monitor what's happening and to hold people accountable for these sorts of practices. In the UK, from where you hail, I believe this is true in the United States as well. How do you try to counter that lack of, well, situational awareness, I guess is one way of putting it, on the part of the authorities?
Sure. I mean, absolutely. And you know, it cannot be right that, you know, when you have somebody at risk of forced marriage, a professional, in cases we can evidence this, has turned a blind eye because they perceive this to be part of culture. They don't want to be rocking the boat. They've been trained to be culturally sensitive. They don't want to offend anybody. They don't want to be called a racist. In one area in the UK, we had over 100 schoolgirls go missing from an education role. These were South Asian girls aged 15 to 16 years old. They went missing in one academic year. Nobody asked where those girls had gone. And they were, so the majority were suspicious with respect to being victims of forced marriage. If over 100 white British females had gone missing off one school roll, the UK would have been jumping up and down. They didn't in that case because these girls were Asian. And that is morally wrong. We raised that. That resulted in a national investigation of girls missing from education in the UK alone in 1 year, which was 2009. There was a concern around over 2,500 young girls missing from school, potentially at risk of forced marriage. The point I'm making here is that we've got to increase accountability to this. In Britain, what we have noticed is a shift in attitude because, and greater accountability because the forced marriage is now a specific criminal offence. What that law has done, it has situated this clearly within the confines of the law, and this notion of this being part of somebody's culture has completely been removed. So the professional now can look at this and say, no, this isn't part of one's religion, belief, tradition. This is against the law in Britain.
Well, and I think in addition to that, of course, and I think this is the role that Karma Nirvana is playing, your organization, if I understand correctly, Yasvinder Sankara, is to enable victims or prospective victims of this forced marriage phenomenon to make known to the authorities that a criminal action is being taken. And the two parts of this are obviously critical to changing things. And presumably this is the kind of message you're conveying to American audiences as well in your tour here, is that right?
Absolutely. Yesterday I was with an organization called Unchained, which are doing work in New York for victims of forced marriages. And what I feel is that, I mean, I've been a campaigner since 1993. America is where I was in 1993, yet we're in 2015. There is a sheer lack of awareness. The other issue here is you do not have a hotline. There is nowhere for victims to call for help. So as we raise awareness, we have to be mindful that we are raising the consciousness of very isolated victims who will probably feel more confident to reach out, which is what we want. And where are they going to call? If they contact a professional, let's say a police officer or a teacher that lacks awareness, that professional could be putting them back with the perpetrators because they are family members.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, if they have violated the honor code, they could be in mortal peril, not simply of psychological abuse or even lesser forms of physical abuse, but their very lives could be forfeit. Unfortunately, we've run out of time to talk about the sort of theological underpinnings of some of these practices, or at least the justifications that people cite in their religious practice. But I hope we'll have a chance to talk about that with you on another occasion. In the meantime, congratulations on what you've done in the United Kingdom and what you're trying to help us understand we need to do here in the United States as well, both through your work at Karma Nirvana and in your book, Shame. We look forward to a further visit soon. We'll look forward to talking with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.